United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. Please be seated. Before we begin the proceedings this morning, I just want to extend my gratitude on behalf of the panel to this law school for being such great hosts and for really making our stay very welcome. So thank you. First case this morning is 16-1077, Intellectual Ventures versus Capital One Financial Corporation. Mr. Feinberg, whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I represent Appellant Intellectual Ventures. I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. First, I'd like to deal with a procedural issue, which is actually under Fourth Circuit law with respect to the 084 patent. The district court improperly certified a partial summary judgment for final appeal under Rule 54B, sua sponte, without anybody asking for it. The district court did so.
What about ILAR versus Google?
I think that all of the cases, Your Honor, have to do with a situation where they effectively, even if you don't have final judgment, that the decision that to which collateral estoppel is being applied is for all intents final. Examples are the Loomis case, where you had a decision.
Well, I think my question is, you're arguing Fourth Circuit. ILAR seems to say Fed Circuit.
I think Fourth Circuit law applies to procedural questions such as the collateral estoppel. I'm pretty sure.
Well, let me quote, whether an order is sufficient to confer appellate jurisdiction under Rule 54B is a question of Federal Circuit law that we review with our precedent.
Regardless of whether it's Federal Circuit or Fourth Circuit law, Your Honor, it doesn't really matter, because in this particular circumstance, what you had is a situation where you're faced with exactly what Wright and Miller tells us we don't want to have happen, which is we don't want a situation where a case goes up to appeal based on collateral estoppel of effect of a judgment that isn't final in the district court, and the district court judge in New York could clearly reverse himself if we so move.
But there's case law in the Fourth Circuit, and it seems pretty liberal and pretty flexible in terms of the requirements. There's Swentech, and there's another case, and it seems that they do not require finality to the extent that it's not no longer appealable, right?
I disagree, Your Honor. Swentech is a very specific case. Swentech, it's true that the decision in Swentech on which collateral estoppel was applied wasn't final, but it was collateral estoppel was applied to a decision in the same case, and the Fourth Circuit hung its hat on the fact that the collaterally estopping decision and the collateral estoppel rule came to it in the same appeal. In addition, it's basically...
I didn't see where it said that. All I saw in Swentech or Pharmacia or cases like that, they all seem to consistently say and inquire on whether there was a true, full, and fair opportunity to litigate the issue, and then was there a result that can be deemed sufficiently final that we can say it has conclusive effect.
So
those cases are basically following down the line of Restatement Second Judgments, Section 13, right?
I disagree. I think Swentech is a very specific set of facts. If you look at pages 561 to 62, it specifically says that the fact that it has both the collateral estoppel rule and the collaterally estopping decision before it at the same time was determinative. So I think that in fact, this was an inappropriate application of collateral estoppel. But also, the 54B itself, the theory of 54B is to prevent undue prejudice.
Wait, are you talking about the issue of whether he should have not granted the 54B because the antitrust issues were still pending?
No, Your Honor, because he shouldn't have entered 54B because the decision on which collateral estoppel was based, the Southern District of New York decision, wasn't final. Nobody asked for it, and by the way, the Fourth Circuit, assuming that law applies, Your Honor, The Fourth Circuit requires specific findings before there is a 54B certification. There weren't any here.
Well, let me just ask you this, and I'll ask the other side this as well, just where all of these other claims stand. What's the status of the – it's the Chase case, right, in Southern District of New York. What is the status of that case now?
The Chase case is proceeding to trial, I think, in March on the 666 patent, which is the sole surviving patent there. As you recall, we asked – when we got the 54B certification, we asked Judge Hellerstein to certify that decision for 54B. He declined, and then we got asked the district in Maryland to vacate the final
What's
judgment.
What's the status of the Maryland case?
The Maryland case has everything is up here except the antitrust counterclaims, which have some but not complete overlap with the patent issues
here.
Yeah,
but what's the status of the antitrust claims?
So we're not involved in that directly,
okay, that's
so I'm
fine.
Not certain.
That's fine. I'm just interested.
I'm sorry, last question. There's an IPR.
The IPR is on all three of the patents.
And where are those now?
In your court, Your Honor.
Fully briefed?
I believe in at least two and maybe all three circumstances they're fully briefed. Two patents.
But they haven't been scheduled for argument.
No. Two patents are have all claims were found invalid. One patent, somewhere. I'd like to move.
You relied pretty heavily on Braswell.
Yes.
I don't know what they call it these days. I call it shepherdizing. But I went and checked it in the computer. And there aren't that many cases that cited in the Fourth Circuit. But the few that do seem to sort of, when they cite it, they still go look at the underlying facts. And it's fairly loose.
It may be loose, Your Honor, but this is a particularly inopportune time to apply either 54B or collateral estoppel, since what we don't have is the underlying merits decision on the 084 patent before you. If the court is inclined to reverse on the procedural issue, I want just briefly to talk about 084. On the merits.
Can I ask you, how do you envision this working out, though? Assume we don't reverse on the procedural issue, and assuming 4 years down the road, your Southern District of New York case comes up to appeal in our court, and we reverse the finding of summary judgment with regard to the 084 patent. What happens to this proceeding? Do you get to reopen this? I mean, I was going to ask Mr. Moore as well, what happens in these circumstances?
You can move under Rule 60. To vacate the judgment, and that's what we do, although we would argue that's not the most efficient use of judicial resources.
And then
resource.
Does that reinstate the judgment as it is, or do you have to file anew? Under 60B, you would reinstate the pending.
Moving to the merits of the 084, which I want to do just very quickly, it's directed to combining network-level intrusion detection with device-level intrusion prevention. It's quite similar to what's going on in Bascom, obviously identical.
I thought your briefing, you didn't want us to reach the 084.
I don't want you to reach it, but I can't control what the court does. So just in case, I think it's inappropriate to do so. But if this court reverses and reaches the merits, I think that I should address it.
Could you have very little time. Could you please address the other two patents?
Sure. So 081 is directed to solving the problem of incompatible XML documents by using a dynamic document. So this is there's no abstract idea here. It's a very specific implementation. Basically, what you have is a dynamic document, which is itself, it's dynamic in a different way than the district court thought it was.
How do you deal with contracting, content extraction?
Because here, it's not just a conventional electronic document, Your Honor. This document does something that is unheard of. What this document does, as the court correctly pointed out, district court, every document is dynamic in the sense you can change it, I suppose. But this document, when you change it, it changes the underlying documents. It's a way to have incompatible XML documents, Your Honor. And when you change the dynamic document, the changes filter back down to the underlying documents.
How does it do that? I was trying to read the patent to figure that out.
Because it has pointers back to the underlying documents such that when the changes are made, the dynamic document points to the underlying XML documents and propagates the changes back through them.
Right. So I guess what you're saying is you have this document, this XML document, that is on its own terms, it's untouchable, but then you create this dynamic document to, that sucks the data out of the XML document, puts it into a, this display called the dynamic document, and then when you make edits to the data in the display, somehow those very changes propagate back to the otherwise untouchable XML document?
Not quite, Your Honor. I think mostly. It's not that the other XML document is untouchable. It's that it's in a, that you have a variety of XML documents in incompatible formats, and it's a way of resolving the incompatibility such that the when you change the dynamic document, it changes the underlying document.
Right, and that's the part I don't understand. I mean, it sounds like it would be a potentially interesting invention if that's what you invented and that's what you've accomplished. But then when I look at the claim, that last step of updating the XML document, it doesn't say how that is accomplished. And so it starts to feel a bit aspirational, a bit results-oriented, and not at all consistent with our requirements for having an inventive concept in cases like electric power.
So the inventive concept here, Your Honor, it is certainly true that it uses conventional technology, and as does Bascom. It's using conventional pointers. The pointers are... So we're not saying that the inventive concept is the pointers themselves. We're saying the inventive concept is the use of a dynamic document that contains pointers, which is the way that the underlying documents get revised. So I would respectfully disagree that it's aspirational.
The representative claim that I'm looking at doesn't say the word pointers, right?
Which representative claim are you looking at, Your Honor?
21.
So 21 tells us...
The last step, a component that detects modification of the data in the dynamic document via the user interface and in response thereto modifies a data component in the XML document.
So at that point, that last step doesn't call for the use of pointers. They're already called for above.
Somewhere else in Claim 21?
Component that maps the data component of each data object to one of the plurality of primary record types, and we know from the specification that the component that does that are the pointers. So it has told us about the pointers earlier, and it is that...
Where are you? What column?
Column 20 at about line 48 to 50.
I'm sorry, I think... Judge Wallach's question, mine is as well, is where in the specification does it talk about the use of pointers in terms of creating the PRQ?
Oh, I thought you were looking at the claim, Your Honor. So the pointers are talked about I think we have it referenced in the spec. I'm just not finding it right away, but it does talk about the use of pointers, and it does tell us that it's not conventional. That the pointers are conventional. So it's not claiming novel pointers. Let me move on very quickly to the last patent because that overlaps a bit with the next case, the 002 patent. So the 002 patent is directed to a mobile interface agent. Again, by the way, this is a case that's kind of interesting. What happened is Special Master Ray Lupo was appointed by the district court. And Special Master Lupo found that neither of the patents that we're speaking of was directed to an abstract idea, and both had an inventive concept. The district court adopted the factual findings, but not the legal conclusions. So in many ways, I'm simply arguing the same findings, same basis that Mr. Lupo.
But Mr. Lupo didn't have the benefit of all the case law that's developed over the past couple of years, right?
Well, of course, Your Honor, and neither did the district court. When the district court decided, and it's clear, in fact, the district court says
so. But we have now multiple decisions that say whenever you claim a magic interface to accomplish some result on a computer network, that's not good enough. That's an abstract idea. That's not really... a technical solution recited in the claim that can be said to be an inventive contribution that's an advance in the useful arts.
Your Honor, I think I would concur if it was a magical mobile interface, but this interface is concrete. It talks about how it is stored on a server, and it moves from device to device. So I don't think it is...
What in the claim tells us what the mobile interface is as opposed to what the desired objective is for the mobile interface to accomplish?
So... What it tells us is...
This time, what point is actually to somewhere?
I'm sorry. I'm looking at column 19, and I'm looking at claim 34 at about 20. So a mobile interface used for retrieving user-specific information, and it's stored on either a local device, and it's adapted to move. And then it says it comprises a plurality of pointers. So that is telling us what it's got. So I think that it is more than simply functional language. It's telling us how it does it using
a... You didn't invent pointers. You already acknowledged that, right?
Pardon?
Your inventors did not invent the use of pointers.
That's correct, Your Honor.
To point to something else on a computer network.
Yeah, I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
We'll restore a couple minutes of rebuttal. But you feel free to answer Judge Chen's question.
We didn't invent pointers, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We'll restore 2 minutes. Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'd like to start where we left off with the 081 patent.
Can you start, though, just on the issue preclusion question? And it is a little odd, is it not? I mean, I know you're arguing the Fourth Circuit precedent is quite flexible, but it doesn't feel a little odd to call a final judgment something from Southern District of New York where it's not been the subject of an appeal yet?
It's certainly not the norm, but it's something that the courts have acknowledged happens. And in this situation, it was a problem created by intellectual ventures' own making. Because here, when the decision came down in the Southern District of New York regarding the invalidity of the 084 patent based on 101, they actually told the court they were going to move for a certification under Rule 54B so it could go up on appeal. But then at the same time, they were arguing issue preclusion to the District of Maryland. And they didn't want to move for a Rule 54B judgment in the Southern District of New York because it would undercut their argument in the District of Maryland that issue preclusion wasn't final.
It's not clear to me that we can rely on these motivations, you know, for a legal proposition. Right now what we have is this peculiar fact pattern where your case is up here first rather than the original underlying case. And it could be years before the actual merits of the validity of the 084 ever come to the Federal Circuit. And yet, you know, you're already here with using that underlying district court decision as a tool to get out of litigating here. That's
exactly right, but the courts have dealt with this both in Pharmacia versus Upjohn, which we cited, and Judge Bryson dealt with it in the Diet Gold case when he was sitting in the Eastern District of Texas. And what he held in that situation is when you have a situation where the collateral estoppel issue goes up before the underlying decision on the merits, in that situation, the party that was avoiding collateral estoppel was saying you should just stay the case. And Judge Bryson pointed out the unfairness of that to a defendant like Capital One, where if we just have to wait to watch the Southern District New York case go up on appeal, then we'll never be heard before the Federal Circuit.
But what happens then if 2 or 3 years from now the Southern District of New York's determination is appealed to us and we reverse? And this case is long gone mandated because we adopted your view with regard to issue preclusion. Do you agree with your friend that there's a 60B motion?
Yes.
And that can be used, and that can reinstate this current appeal?
Yes.
So that there's okay. All
right. And then, is your understanding would be that you would not object, you would not oppose such a 60B5 motion by the other side if, hypothetically, the New York case came up to the Federal Circuit 3-4 years from now, we were to reverse on that invalidity judgment, and then they moved to vacate the judgment in Maryland, you wouldn't object to their 60B5 motion?
Well, it depends on a lot of factors, and we'd have to wait to see.
Just based on the factors I described, I mean, it wouldn't seem like there's a good reason for you to still object.
If this court reversed on the merits of 101 and sent it back down, in that situation, we would not oppose the Rule 60 motion, or I could understand facts similar to that suggesting we couldn't oppose the Rule 60 motion, but we would still reserve our right to argue it independently. It would be heard on our own.
On the merits.
Correct, on the merits.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
And to be clear, assuming that 60B motion was granted, that would be in effect as if this case on 084 in Maryland had just been resurrected as if it had been stayed on the books for 3-4 years, right?
Like
the complaint would still be there, and it would be resuscitated in essence.
Most likely correct.
But clearly the case would pretty much be precluded, the merits case, because we would have determined on appeal, finally, that the patent is valid. I mean, under this hypothetical we're talking about.
But it's assuming that's the case, but we might have a different position and want to be fully heard on it. That's why Judge Bryson points out in the Diacol case, in a situation like this, what a defendant has the option to do is not just raise the collateral estoppel issue, but also when they get on appeal, raise the merits and defend the merits, even though the underlying decision on the merits hasn't been ripe for appeal yet. The defendant who won under collateral estoppel can independently raise the merits defense so they can be heard in the Federal Circuit. And in this case, you asked the question about what's the status of the other case. The 084 patent's a great one because that's pending against 8 other banks and 8 other districts. There's also 2 IPRs going on regarding that patent. Intellectual Ventures made an attack against the entire banking industry based on about 10 different
patents. So are the other district courts that are hearing the 084 issues, are they going to also do issue preclusion? Have some of them also decided this on issue preclusion grounds?
Most of them have just stayed the case pending the IPRs.
But so the IPRs aren't a 101 issue. Is it a 101 issue, or it's a 102 or 103?
102 and 103, not 101.
So the other side tried to distinguish away Swentech, saying as a factual matter that was sort of the use of issue preclusion collateral estoppel within the same case, and cited to 561, 562 of Swentech for that. Mm-hmm. Can you explain why, in your view, they must be wrong?
I don't think it accurately characterizes what Swentech says. If you look at Swentech, you had 2 decisions below. It was first before Judge Kacharis in the Eastern District of Virginia, and he entered a decision on the case. But because of the decision he entered, he actually stepped back and then let Judge Hilton handle the case. And Judge Hilton's the judge who overlooked the jury verdict. And where he found collateral estoppel, he found it based on a jury verdict, one jury verdict. And then based on that, they appealed Judge Hilton's finding. And so it's a normal situation of collateral estoppel based on an earlier decision, based on an earlier fact-finding. They refer in their briefs that it's based on a fact-finding by a judge and a jury, 2 separate fact-finders. But if you look at the description of the facts, it only talks about Judge Hilton's collateral estoppel finding being based on the jury verdict. And when you look at the application section of the Swentech case, it doesn't mention the 2 different fact-findings at anywhere during the application section.
Well, before we leave 60B and...
We're going to let you get to the merits, we promise, eventually.
And these fun hypotheticals. I just want to say... I see the beginning of a fabulous civil procedure question for some future students. And so following along that line, when you're back there arguing 60B-5, I imagine the professor is going to throw in some other outside fact which wasn't thought of when we were discussing this thing, and you're going to be up there, and your opposing counsel is going to be up there saying, he conceded.
We've got an outside fact today on here, Your Honor, on an exact point. We'd rather win today on the merits. We believe the 084 patent is a very easy decision under 101. Capital
but you
one
convinced
five,
the district court to not hear that on the merits.
We gave them both options. We briefed both. We briefed the merits as well. And what you've got with the 084 patent is not one, but 2 adjudicators have already found it invalid under 101. You've got the Southern District of New York, and they also have Special Master Lupo. You would be the 3rd decider of that issue. But what's important here is Capital One deserves finality. Invalid patents need to be taken off the books. Capital One has 5 cases on its corporate disclosures. This is one of it. And intellectual
I'm sorry,
ventures,
can you just go to the merits of the 081 and 002?
I mean, yeah, why don't you start with the 081, please, if you wouldn't mind. Is that okay with you?
Yes. With regard to the 081, let's first start where my friend left off. First, we heard the term pointers. The term pointers is clear.
Isn't this some kind of technical tool? I mean, it's a collaborative tool that allows users to edit otherwise uneditable documents. I mean, that sounds like something technical is going on here.
It's not a technical tool. It's a business tool. If you look at the claims, all these claims are about organizing invoices data
purchase orders. What they're trying to accomplish here is wrestling with documents that otherwise recipients can't edit. And now they've provided a solution to that problem by creating these things called dynamic documents. And then through the dynamic documents, you can now edit what was once previously uneditable. I'm sorry, that's not a real word, but you get my gist.
Well, all they're doing is reorganizing the data. They admit in the background of this patent that this problem of getting data in different different formats existed before the 081 patent. And they admit that in the past, people have been creating programs to reconcile XML documents in different formats, and they create a program to merge them into a common format and then to filter them and then to transform them. That was all. That's all in the background of the patent.
And so that may deal with the 102 or 103 issue. I guess I'm having a hard time distinguishing this from the DDR case. I mean, DDR was very much about something that's rooted in computer world that didn't exist outside the computer world. All these claims are about are modifying an XML document that doesn't exist outside of the computer world. So I'm having a hard time differentiating this between what we said in DDR.
This case is different from DDR in three reasons. First is the one you're referring to. The problem here is not necessarily rooted in computer technology. Here it's a business problem. Here they admitted that they're using conventional computer technology to just organize data from these different documents. There's nothing new in the computer technology. They're not improving the operation of the
computers. But I see that more as a step two issue, a step two argument. But on step one, on whether or not it's an abstract idea, I know DDR might have been a little unclear about whether it was doing it under step one and step two. But what about step one? I mean, leaving aside whether or not it's inventive or not, whether the technology is new, it is entirely a computer technologically rooted issue that's dealt with in this claim, right?
Only by a field of use limitation that limits it to XML. And there's nothing about these claims that's specific to computer technology. You could use it for XML documents. You could use it for hard copy documents. You could use it for Microsoft Word documents. There's nothing about these claims. What's important under step one is that they're all directed to an abstract idea because all the steps in this claim are purely functional. They just claim the result. If you look at the claims
for hard copy documents.
Because you can take a hard copy document, let's take the steps of Claim 21, you can organize the data components into data objects by simply saying, I've got name, you know, Matt Moore puts an invoice for widget A at price X. And then I can identify a record type, and I can simply identify the record name, address, right, widget, quantity. And then I can take that data, and then I can put it, because it's in an invoice, it's in a management record type.
Right.
So you can do it for any type of document. That's why it's not a problem necessarily rooted in technology. The other reasons it's distinguished from DDR is because there's nothing about this that improves the operation of the computer functionality itself
but what
or
if,
the Internet.
What if it is an improvement to the functionality of the computer if now it can be recognized as a tool for allowing users to do something that they couldn't do before?
The test for whether it improves the computer functionality is laid out clearly in Electric Power, where it talks about improving the functionality of the computer itself versus using existing computer technology to aid in the performance of a process. And we heard in the opening argument where they admitted they're using computer technology to aid in the process. There's nothing in the claims.
But, we're in a difficult line-drawing exercise with these Section 101 cases. And the things that you're saying right now are things that could also be or have been said about claims in DDR or BASCOM. Those were the use of conventional technologies. But then there was some kind of twist in those claims that then solved a vexing problem. And what I'm trying to figure out here is if these claims right here are using conventional technologies, but with some kind of interesting twist that solved an otherwise vexing problem. You're saying to us that well, all the claim limitations are functional. They're all recited at a functional level. And I know you want us to understand and believe that, but when you get down to it, you know, all these claims, good claims and bad claims, are recited at some level of abstraction. So what we need to think about is trying to figure this out on a deeper level, which functional claims are okay versus the functional claims that are not okay.
Yes.
So how do you draw that line?
You draw that line with the same analysis. If you look at the court's case law first, you look at, does it solve a technological problem? You look at, does it improve the functionality of the computer? And you look, does it do it in a specific way? In DDR, you had all those. The problem was unique to the Internet because you couldn't magically transform from your location in one store to your magic location in another store. Here, you don't have that situation because here the problem predated the idea of organizing data in different documents and putting them into a new format is a problem that existed long before the XML documents.
I guess I'm trying to think of what if someone invented something like a way to change the data in a received PDF document, right? Maybe Chief Judge Prost is sending me a draft opinion she wants me to take a look at and recommends that I do whatever edits I want to it, but she sends it to me in a PDF document. And I open up her email, I say, oh, I can't touch that, it's a PDF. But then someone comes up with a tool and says, well, we're going to suck all the data out of this PDF, we're going to create something called a dynamic document. And then as you're typing away in the dynamic document, it's going to actually propagate all those changes back into the underlying PDF. So now I have the ability to do something I could not have done before, which is to edit this PDF document. Isn't that something that could be considered a technical solution to a technical problem?
The key is how it's claimed and whether you're claiming the idea of, wouldn't it be neat if I could edit this document? That's the idea level. That's the abstract idea level. You can't patent the idea. To patent it, what you need is to add the specific solution, the specific implementation details that would allow you to make those changes. And if those, depending what those details are, weren't abstract, then you could patent it.
What's wrong with why is it not enough to claim creating all these PRTs and the PRTs create an MRT, and from the MRT you have a dynamic document?
It's not enough because those are just generic labels for generic data formats. If you look at what Intellectual Ventures itself said in its gray brief at page 4, it defined the core of their invention. And it said the core of their invention is it must be usable by a non-programmer, it must be dynamic, and it must operate on multiple sets of data with different data structures. Even Intellectual Ventures didn't even try to characterize MRTs or PRTs as the inventive concept, as the invention, when they describe the core of their invention on page 4. And you look at their own constructions. Their construction of a PRT is a data structure that includes data from an XML document, any data structure. There's nothing specific about it. It's conventional. MRTs are just a collection of the PRTs, which are these generic data structures.
Have you read this patent, the 081?
Yes.
Okay. Can you explain to me your understanding of how this 081 patent, once the data is edited in the dynamic document, all those edits somehow propagate back to the underlying XML document?
No, I can't, Your Honor, because the patent doesn't explain that. And most importantly, there's nothing about that.
Your opposing counsel says there's pointers. It discusses the use of pointers, and somehow the pointers through the PRTs get back into the underlying data and then edit the data.
The important thing here, the 081 patent does talk about pointers, but pointers are not in the claims of the 081 patent. The pointers are only in the 002 patent. And the pointers are described regarding figure 3 of the 081 patent, and particularly in column 5, lines 13 through 28. But importantly here, there's nothing about those pointers in the claim. And when you get to propagating data, they made the same point in their brief. If you look at claim 21, the last element of it states, a component that detects modification of data in the dynamic document. So it performs the result of detecting a modification. Doesn't tell you how, but it does the function of that, the result, via user interface. And in response thereto, all it does is modify a data component in an XML document. There's nothing about it propagating back to other XML documents or specific XML documents. In fact, all it does is modify a data component in AND. AND's an indefinite article. It means any XML document. It doesn't even have to be the ones that were originally entered. So there's nothing in these claims about the changes propagating back.
Okay. We're more than out of time, but we can even out the time. Mr. Moore, why don't you take a couple minutes to do what you started to want to do, which is to talk about the 002 patent. I think that's where you wanted to start, so why don't we conclude with a couple minutes on that?
Well, with regard to the 002 patent, it's got the same problems as the 081 and the 084. The claims here are purely functional. If you look at Claim 9 of the 002 patent, the abstract idea is just retrieving user-specific information using pointers. And step one of the Claim 9 is retrieving a mobile interface. It's just retrieving it. Doesn't say how. Step two, displaying a mobile interface. Doesn't say how. Third step, retrieving the user-specific information. Classic functional language that just claims the result without the how. It's an abstract idea. We also have this in their own definition of a mobile interface. They define a mobile interface as something that's accessible on different computing devices. They claim how it's accessible, the result, but they don't claim anything about what makes it accessible. Same thing with regard to accessing user-specific information. They claim the result that it can access it at different locations, but they don't claim the how. And when you compare this to claims that are already have been already found invalid, you've got the first Intellectual Ventures versus Capital One case, where there you had an interface that was claimed purely functional, and that was found insufficient under Step 1 or Step 2 to transform the claim. Judge Chen made the comment earlier, there's a number of these cases. The recent Affinity Labs case versus Amazon dealt with a customized user interface that had a list of items, pointers, and it was still found to be unpatentable under 101. And the Internet patent case is the same thing, because there you have an intelligent user interface that had hyperlinks, a specific type of pointer, and it was still insufficient under Step 1 or Step 2. So for all those reasons, we believe the 002 claims are also invalid under 101.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So you had run out of your time. We were going to give you some rebuttal. And Mr. Moore, we kept him over for 5 minutes. So we will keep things even by giving you 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay? If you need it.
Okay. So I want to just touch base briefly again on 084, which is...
Can you speak up a little? I'm sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. Not a problem I usually have. So 084, this is the procedural issue. I think that the appropriate result here is, since there hasn't been a merits determination in this case, the Maryland case, it ought to be stayed, sent back, vacated. I mean, typically what the Fourth Circuit would do with understanding this...
Wait, why would we stay it? We would stay it... pending the final appeal of the SD New York case?
Yes. What the Fourth Circuit would do, or what it said it would do in similar circumstances, is it would summarily send the case back for findings, specific findings under 54B as to why the prejudice to Intellectual Ventures was outweighed by the need to appeal.
What would be the prejudice? We were talking already this morning about the idea that if you, in fact, prevail on an appeal from the New York case for the 084, you can simply go back to the Maryland court and file a 60B5 motion, and then you'll be right back where you need to be in terms of asserting the 084 against Capital One.
That is yes, we can make the 60B motion, and then we get to see if it's granted. I assume it would be granted under the facts that we have, but it seems to me that the more efficient use of judicial resources is simply to send at least that patent back.
You could assume it would be granted under the record that was created in this court.
One would assume. I would also like to talk
about
barring extenuating changes.
Yes.
The most efficient thing would be for us to decide the merits of the issue. I mean, sending it back is just another drag on the efficiency of the system, right?
Yes, although it is not fully briefed at this court. We did not, it was not an alternative ground by the district court. So the district court simply didn't say, and by the way, if you don't apply collateral estoppel, then on the merits, it's invalid under 101. It never reached the merits. So this court would be deciding it for the first time.
So although you were arguing about the 084 a little bit in your opening argument before I cut you off, you don't want us to reach the merits
That's
of the
correct.
084.
That is correct.
Okay.
We think it's inappropriate. The 081, I think, is I'd like to use my remaining time since 002 comes up in the next argument. 081 is not directed to an abstract idea in the first place. It is very similar to what we have in EnFish, right? We have a new data structure in EnFish, and what we've got here is a new data structure, which at the top of the data structure is this dynamic document. And the notion, and my friend has said, well, it's conventional. Dynamic document is conventional. Well, it's not conventional. In fact, the examples that Capital One used in this court and in the district court show how unconventional it is. The Capital One says, well, we're a bank. We create dynamic documents or summary documents all the time. You get your checks come in and the deposits come in, and that creates a summary, and that's a dynamic document.
Let's go back to electric power. Okay, I think electric power is a pretty good marker for where we are at this point on 101 law. Electric power says, if your claims are focused on recognizing data, extracting data, displaying data, that's an abstract idea. Data manipulation, at least on a high level of generality, is an abstract idea. So you're stuck with that.
I agree.
Now you have to tell us why what you have is above and beyond that.
Because it's more than abstract data manipulation. You know, at some level, the district court said it's just data manipulation, but it's not. It creates a whole new data structure for handling incompatible XML documents themselves, a creature of the internet. These are, contrary to my friend, these are not like handwritten documents.
It's not clear to me, though, why it matters the origins of what type of data or what type of document the data comes from. Data is data. Transferring it from one document to another document, you want to call it a dynamic document, fine. Transferring data from a document to a display, is one way to regard your claims.
Well, my time's up. Can I answer the question, Your Honor?
Yes.
So it's more than that, Your Honor. That is one of the things it does. But the thing that makes this dynamic document so unusual and non-abstract is that not only does it display it, but changes you make to the dynamic document propagate to the underlying documents, and they're shown in the figures. And my colleague says, well, that's just like a bank statement, except we'd all be pretty surprised if the bank statement changed and the checks and deposits underlying them also changed.
Let me just ask a couple quick questions before you go. Is my analogy to a PDF document off base?
Yes, you can actually change a PDF document.
All right.
But you would change the PDF document. But it's a good example. Suppose you had a Word document.
A second question. Where in the spec does it tell me how you take the changes you made in your display and it changes the underlying XML document?
So I think the best place I can show you is the figures 1 and 2. And answer the question you asked about PDF. So in PDF, if I change a PDF document, it doesn't change the underlying Word document. So it's a one-way.
Okay, direction. I'm sorry. You have to go. Where's the site in the patent?
It said figure 1 and figure 2?
Yep. The description.
Okay. Is he done?
Are you looking for a citation or are you done?
Oh, I was showing you I was referring to particularly figures 1 and 2 in the description.
Okay.
And that's the end. Okay. Thank you. We thank both parties in the cases.